went back and looked back through my notes, and again, I don't know. It's one of those things where professors throw stuff out in class, and you're trying to keep up, and you know you're writing like crazy. But in my notes, again, it's in my Bible and in my notes. How many prophecies in chapter 11 here? Dave, you can't answer because we talked about it this morning. Howard probably has got that bear trap of a memory.
It hasn't come up yet.
Oh. Anybody remember? It's a whole bunch. Glenn? 135. 135 prophecies. And I think last week you got a little taste of how condensed portions of God's word is, where we went through a couple hundred years on this chart of all these different rulers, north and south, north and south, north and south, north and south, and all the intrigue and who's given their daughter to the other to try to get it. And it's all about getting over on one another and getting an advantage. Anything new in that? That's just classic standard business practices. Yeah. Republicans and Democrats. Yeah. And each blaming each other and trying to gain an advantage. And so we've come down now in our portion to verses 21 to 35. The next individual here, Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus took this name upon himself, the glorious one, the outshining one. He wanted to be known as God and claimed himself to be God. And he, on your chart, is the last of the northern of the Seleucids, and he comes to power by intrigue. The throne wasn't his right, and yet he comes in and kills off his brother's kids and takes over the throne. So we'll just start down through here. You all got the first part of this all figured out. You went home last week and got her all down, huh? Well, good. God gives more information about this following individual than any of the others that we've seen because of, remember, this entire section. Daniel, back in the beginning of this section in chapter 10, had spent 3 weeks kind of out in isolation. There were others there, but he was up to the north of the city there and on the river and just kind of mourning before the Lord and asking God, why is the temple not being built? The remnant has returned to the land. They've been there for 2 years. How come the temple isn't being rebuilt? What's going on? What about your people, O Lord? And so God is telling him in this section, here's what's pertaining to Israel in the near future. And then with this individual here ends that whole period. And then he's going to jump when we get over to verses 36 to 45, and we'll talk about that, then the king will do as he pleases. And verse 35, you see it ends that there will be a purge will be made until the people are pure, until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. So the question is, does verses 36 to 45 carry on with this discussion of Antiochus Epiphanes, or is this a eschatological leap into the future covering Antichrist, of who Antiochus Epiphanes is just a type? And we've already talked about this before. Antiochus Epiphanes foreshadows. He's a type of the final Antichrist. And a lot of the things we read about Antiochus here are very similar and mirror the end time ruler. A lot of similarities. He comes forward in intrigue. He's got all the answers. He's able to sway the people to his side. Then he comes in and brutalizes the Jews and takes control of the temple, takes control of Israel, and demands to be worshipped as God. A lot of similarities between the historical Antiochus that's already come versus Antichrist that is yet to come. And we'll talk more about that when we get there. But in verse 21, it says, in his place, a despicable person will arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. This is a reference to Antiochus Epiphanes, who comes, as again I said, he's the last one on your chart here. He comes after Seleucus the IV, Philopater. And you remember that Antiochus comes forward. We talked last time, we ended up with the tax collector that Seleucus, the fourth Philopater, Rome had come in, is coming into power now, and he had to pay them so much money annually, he didn't have the money. And so he's got this tax collector named Heliodorus, and he's sending him out throughout the kingdom to collect more taxes in order to pay Rome and to keep money in his coffers. And so the people revolt against that, and history tells us, extra-biblical history says, that Heliodorus, the tax collector, poisoned Seleucus the fourth Philopater. Just couldn't take the pressure anymore. We hear about IRS guys that snap all the time, don't we? Not really. We hear about those that they're pursuing snapping. So Heliodorus, the tax collector, apparently assassinated Seleucus the fourth Philopater, and so that left a vacuum. One of Seleucus's sons was being held in Rome as a prisoner to be sure Pop would send the tax monies. So he's got the teenage son's captive in Rome. And then he had a baby son, and so Antiochus Epiphanes, as he comes to power, he slays the youngest son to be able to come to power. All of these earlier kings that we've looked at on this chart last week, that whole back and forth, that progression back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, all of that was leading up to this final individual that's going to seize control. His design is on, certainly on Egypt and all he can control. But what he really wants is Israel. He wants to be the bright and shining one. He wants to be God. Who from the very beginning wanted to be God and was thrown out because of it?
Morning star type guy.
Yeah.
I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That's why the shining is
Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28. That's the origin of Satan and the fall of Satan in those two passages. As Ron Allen says, those two passages and what went on in the garden, a couple verses there, and just a couple other references, Job chapter 1 and 2. Those are the only passages of Satan that are right out here. He is a picture of him that says this is Satan. There's only a few snapshots like that in the Bible, and the reason being because I love what Ron Allen said. This isn't his book. It's not about him. It's about Jesus Christ, the true shining one, the eternal glorious one. Ken? Well, you might use that as an illustration of Satan, but that specifically is talking about,
yes.
It's talking more about creation and all the might in different animals of creation. And here he's using Leviathan, the crocodile, and some take it symbolically, but specifically he's using the crocodile as a picture of pride in the animal creation. And how can you tame the crocodile is the point there. No, absolutely not. Because verse 34, he looks on everything. He's king over all the sons of pride. He's king over his realm in the animal creation. So he's throughout here he's using symbolic poetic language to talk about creation and animals and how they're prideful, and then trying to apply that to Job as being his problems are because of his sin, because of pride is the point of this speech. So I don't.
That was just a thought and a thing I've had in my mind.
Specifically, if you want one that is specifically Satan, look at Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. Mm-hmm. Talks about his creation and his fall because mm-hmm. pride was found in him, and he wanted to lift himself up and be like the Most High. Mm-hmm. And so those he empowers is here Antiochus. What's Antiochus' dream and aspirations? He goes in and destroys the Jews, kills thousands of them, 80,000. Took women and children captive. He was brutal, as we'll read about here. But that in Job, I personally wouldn't take that as Satan, because it's specifically in the context is referring to the crocodile and how that animal is prideful. And he's trying to apply that to Job to get Job to confess, yes, that's me. So just this give and take with his three friends. Everybody needs somebody like that to come visit you at the hospital. When you've had half your guts removed, right? It's all because of your sin. And there's people that believe that. And I don't know how folks would be much comforted with that type of theology. But anyway, Antiochus comes to power. He's a despicable person on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred. He had to come to power and kill his brother's younger son in order to take control because he wasn't right in line for the throne. And so he didn't think anything about that. He came in and used intrigue, won the people over, and had a real way with words. This guy was a real politician. What's the final Antichrist going to do? What's he going to be like? We read about him back in Daniel chapter 9. Very smooth. He's going to be an economic genius. Do you see the newest billionaires in America? These guys got computer screens all around them, and they're day traders and fund hedge fund traders. I don't understand anything about it. I get a headache looking at one screen, trying to figure out numbers. But they bet on what the stocks are going to do later today or tomorrow. And they buy billions of dollars, blocks of stocks, and if they guess right, they make billions more. And they're doing it just to buy into this guy's investments. Cost you $1 million to buy in. But nobody has done what he can do. And there's a number of them. There was a special on TV a couple weeks ago. I like those kind of specials. I don't understand them, but it just amazes me the genius of some of these people. They said we have more teenage millionaires in America today because of the stock market than anybody. And I'm sure they're doing it in China. Had a young man that helped set up the Chinese stock exchange. He was a computer genius from China. He was at seminary, at Capital Seminary, the first time I went to teach. And he was in the World Trade Center on his way to work that morning when the plane slammed into it. He was stuck in the subway late that morning for some reason. And he got saved through all of that. He came to Jesus Christ, committed his life, left the multi-million dollar stock world and came to seminary to be trained in God's word to go back to Shanghai and give them what they really need, the word of Jesus Christ. And what a testimony that young man had. And he said that the different traders, he said he was a computer guy. He wasn't a numbers guy. But he got with the numbers guys as he was plugging up the system, and they were telling him, save every yen that you have and put it here and put it here. So he said he started saving and pulling together all the money, got his family, got every dime they could get. Within a couple months after that opened, they flipped the switch and turned it on. He was a multimillionaire. Had nightclubs in Shanghai. He said, man, was he living the life. As a young man, a young computer genius. And came to the States, was in the investment banking for China in New York City. And when the World Trade Center came down, that got his picture. And God, through a series of events, he received Christ. And dramatic salvation, where you leave the world and come to seminary to be trained to go back to your people. And so he's got my number. When he gets done, he's supposed to call me, Pastor Chuck, to Shanghai. I'm ready to go.
He didn't share any of those stock market secrets with us.
No, he didn't. But what an amazing...
If you have the computer, you should be able to make it work.
What an amazing story, though. His wife was also very much into the world, into worldly things, and they had a big home here in outside of Washington in Baltimore. After he got saved, he came home all excited, sharing it with his wife, and he said that she did not want it, and he said they had always got along and loved each other, but man, it started World War III in their home. He said several times his wife came after him with butcher knives, even in his sleep. Was going to kill him, get the demons out of him. The only way to do that is kill him and set him free from them demon spirits. And he said it was horrible. He said he had to flee his house with her chasing him with a butcher knife. So he had going to a Chinese Baptist church in Baltimore. He called the elder like at 2 in the morning, the pastor or one of the elders, and they told him, come meet us at the church. He said 3 or 4 of them showed up at the church and laid hands on him and prayed. His wife gets saved. And then her folks come from China, and they think that they've totally lost their minds. They get saved. And the mother's baptized, and the sister's baptized, but the dad, he don't know about all this. He'll take Jesus, but he's going to hold off on baptism for a while. Just incredible stories. Anyway, I don't know. How did I get off on that? I'm sorry?
How did you hear about that story?
I was teaching at Capital Seminary, and he was in my class. And we go to lunch every day, and different ones would share. I'd ask different ones to share their story, and his just, we were all spellbound with his story. Fabulous. Well, Heliodorus, history records that Heliodorus does it in his motives, just too much pressure. It may have been Antiochus. I don't know. We'll That's one of those things. Howard will ask them to rerun that portion for us when we get up there. If you're interested, they'll have it in memory up there for you.
Hold the color.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hold the color. So he comes to power and seizes the throne for himself. Kingship was not conferred upon him. He killed his brother's son. He seized the kingdom by intrigue. And then verse 22, and the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. So he comes in, takes power. Any force that stands against him is not able to stand. Antiochus battled the Egyptians initially, and this verse describes an overflowing flooding away of forces opposed to him. Ptolemy the VI, who is in power now, Antiochus soundly defeated him, and he was not able to come against him. And after an alliance is made, here we're back into these alliances, so keep in mind, north and south, and they're making an alliance, they cut a peace treaty, and as you study history and study Antiochus, he's just a 21st century politician. He would lie right to your face and kiss your baby and sit down at the peace table with you until he could figure out where your weakness was and gain an advantage, and then he'd stick the knife in you. Sound like a politician today? And I know, Larry, I'm getting a little cynical here. Just trying to make it real, guys. He would always... I'm sorry, Curtis.
Who did you say
Richard?
Killed?
He killed his brother's...
So he wasn't actually even in the right
no.
mind to be king, huh?
No, he had to he killed off his brother's son, who was the successor, but he was just a baby. And so he killed him and seized the throne for himself. And then verse 23, after an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception, and he will go up and gain power with a small force of people. And back up in verse 22, with an overflowing force, he flooded Egypt and defeated Ptolemy the VI and gave way before him. And he also shattered the prince of the covenant. He also killed Onias the III, who was high priest in Israel. He also killed him, the prince of the covenant, the one that was serving Yahweh in Jerusalem. He killed him as well, and that was part of his taking advantage of the Jewish state. And this took place around 172 BC. I know some of you are trying to track the time frame through here. Around 172 is when he came into Jerusalem and killed Onias the III, called Prince of the Covenant. And then in verse 23, after an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception. So he cuts a peace treaty around 170 with Ptolemy the VI, according to historians. Around 170 BC, he sits down at the table and comes to a peace accord with Ptolemy the VI in Egypt. And after the treaty was made, and the only reason that he made a treaty was to advance his own causes and to wait until there was a weakness and he could seize control. Everything he did was about control and how to gain an advantage, and he would lie, deceive, and do anything he had to do. And as I study this guy's character, you know who he reminds me of? And this, who?
Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton. Bill and Hill. That's who he reminds me of. And I don't know, maybe that's out of place. I don't know.
I think it says somewhere over here that he didn't have any use for women.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, that's...
I don't know about Antiochus, but
old Bill.
Old Antichrist.
Yeah, Antichrist won't, and Bill certainly didn't fit that part of the profile. But so he goes up, so he's going to go down in, and he makes this peace accord, and notice he's able to go up in verse 23. It says he goes up, but actually he goes down to gain power and control with a small force of people over Ptolemy. He's befuddled Ptolemy. He's deceived him. And he's kind of at peace, and so he's got his crack troops. I mean, the guys that are highly trained, and he gains power and overpowers him with a small force with this inside circle that are maybe dressed like politicians, but really they're henchmen, they're killers. And he's able to get control as he comes in with this small force. Verse 24, In a time of tranquility, he will enter the richest parts of the realm, and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors. And he will distribute plunder, booty, and possessions among them, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. Only for a time. Remember, this book is all about God's sovereignty, isn't it? And he raises up and permits and does as he pleases to accomplish his purposes. And the thing that's interesting here in 24 is he's able to pass through all the realms of, remember, Syria up to the north controlled all of the old Babylonian Persian Empire, encroached over into Asia, and now he's gone into Egypt. He's trying to control that. He's trying to control everything. And as he's pillaging and plundering, he's taken more money and more wealth than any of his ancestors, but he's super deceptive, and his end is to bribe everybody. So everywhere he goes, he uses his wealth to bribe others to accomplish what his fathers never did. He distributed his plunder and his booty. So he didn't just hoard it all for himself. He used it. He reminds me of the senators. Do you see the one on the news that's in trouble now, the one from Alaska? Millions of dollars for a big fish aquarium up there for his buddies, and had his Alaskan house, and didn't look like that great of a place to me. He didn't have tree architects design or that joint. Just a normal looking place, but huge. And some big company up there that he's awarded a lot of contracts to picked up the bill on a lot of it, I guess. And it's amazing, these investigative reporters, man, they get in and just keep digging and digging and digging. So this guy was almost crying. He was in tears. They're just hurting the state of Alaska with these malicious charges against me. I've done nothing wrong. You know, and the guy's the longest seated congressman we've got, I guess. And now they're just unraveling all this. Is that true of the majority of them? I think it probably is. Well, there I go again, Larry. Kick me. Sit over here closer and kick me.
You're to call on temp for a word necessary.
I'm sorry?
Is Al Antiochus in that investigation anywhere? Do you suppose that they'd anybody like for him to fall?
I'm sure they would. Always somebody in the wings waiting to take their place,
yeah,
isn't there?
They want to pick off them strong ones.
So he distributes plunder and possessions among them, but he does it all in order to come up with new schemes against strongholds. In other words, how can I take that place over there? It's too strong for me. I know the keeper of the gate is Curtis. Send a bribe to Curtis. Send him a trip out here to Jericho, to the spa, and get some of those Midianite girls in there and take care of him. I mean, this guy I don't know if he ever slept. He was just totally possessed with taking over everything, and he wanted control of everything. Who is his father? Satan. Satan is the one behind these individuals when you read about them. But this one just epitomizes Satan. And he will stir up his, verse 25, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. And this is Ptolemy the VI. This is around 170 BC. And the king of the south will immobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. So keep in mind, Antiochus is a schemer, and he's a manipulator. And he finds out who's in charge and how to get to him, and he bribes him, and he gets it done. So that in the end, verse 26, those who eat at his choice foods will destroy him, and his army will overflow, but many will fall down slain. This is just so interesting to me that the king of the south, Ptolemy the VI, assembled a huge army, bigger than Antiochus's, but Antiochus takes him out. And those who eat his food, his choice food at his table. So how did Antiochus do it? He bribed his officials, and he eventually takes him out. Verse 27, and for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other at the same table, but it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. So they bring about a peace accord. This fighting's doing neither of us any good. We're just losing men, choice men. There's no reason for this fighting. We can get along after all. So they sit down at the table and they make a peace agreement with one another. And apparently Ptolemy, his army's devastated, and all of his counselors, those who eat with him, they destroy him through this peace accord. The peace accord brings forth a pseudo peace. It's just a false peace. And his end is going to come at the appointed time. So this peace accord will only last for a little while, and then he's going to be swept away. Antiochus returns home with much plunder, and then his interest once again, as he passes back up through Israel, these next verses, his emphasis changes from Egypt now on Israel. When he comes back through verse 28, he returns from Egypt with much to his land with much plunder, but his heart is set against the Holy Covenant, against the Holy Land, against the Mosaic Law and those who practice it. And he will take action and then return to his own land. There was a Jew named Jason who wanted to be high priest. And Jason, having these political ambitions, knowing Antiochus and how he loved bribes and how he was, you know, no good for nothing, Jason offered Antiochus a bribe to depose the high priest Annas the Third. But instead, Antiochus cooperated, and Annas the Third ends up being killed. Antiochus executed certain individuals for their alleged roles in maneuverings against him. Those who tried to support Annas the high priest, Annas the Third, Antiochus killed anyone that didn't do what he wanted done. And Jason and Menelaus were trying to come to power, but Jason, after his coup of trying to take over, Antiochus came in there and he took over and slaughtered over 80,000 Jews, according to history, and began to set up his own. He desecrated the temple. This is around 168 BC, and took over for himself. Was the result of all of this, according to extra biblical history, secular history. And the period of the book of the Maccabees, again, if you're interested in this, they record some of these maneuverings in the book of the Maccabees. In verse 29, it says, "In that at the appointed time, he will return and come into the south, but this last time it will not turn out the way that it did before." So he goes back to Egypt again to beat up on them some more and get some more booty. And loot, and but as he comes down there, and last week I made a mistake. Last week I talked about over in Asia, where one of the Antiochus the Third, the Great, came against the Roman general as he was moving to go against Greece. That one of the early German Roman generals came ashore and told him, "Get out, or we'll kill you." And so I said that this general had drew a circle in the sand around him and said, "Decide what you're going to do before you step out of that circle." Because he said, "Well, I can't decide." And I applied that to the wrong Antiochus last week. I was getting too excited ahead of myself. That incident is coming up right now in this verse, in verse 30. The ships of Kittim are the ships of Rome. And the German, I'm sorry, not the German, the Roman is Papilius Lanius of Rome. He's the general that Antiochus pushes through Egypt, and he comes to Alexandria, which is the capital. And Linus comes ashore, and he's the one that takes his walking stick and draws a circle around Antiochus Epiphanes, because he said, "Well, I can't decide." And he said, "Well, as long as you decide before you step out of that circle." And so he had to humble himself, and he decides to return home. And Linus says that's a wise decision, because Rome was becoming stronger and stronger, and to try to go against Rome at this time, Antiochus would have been swept away, and he knew that. So at the time he comes into Egypt, verse 30, he's coming down there, but this time it's not going to turn out the way it did before. Last time he had the upper hand, he destroyed Ptolemy's army, pillaged him, and went home and pillaged Jerusalem and killed the high priest and was really setting the stage for himself. But in verse 30, as he's down in Egypt, he's in Alexandria, and the ships of Kittim, that's Rome, they come against him. Therefore, he will be disheartened and will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant, the Orthodox of Israel. and take action so he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant, those who forsake the Lord God, those who forsake orthodoxy and forsake the Mosaic Covenant. He shows regard for them. He pays them, anyone who will throw aside the following God and accept him, he pays them and supports them and blesses them. And his whole design when he comes back through here is to take over, as we're going to read in these next verses here. So get the picture. He's in Alexandria, and Popilius Linus from Rome comes ashore, draws a circle around him, tells him, decide what you're going to do before you step out of the circle. He humbled himself, stuck his tail between his legs, and headed for Jerusalem, and just brought devastation to them. And anyone that sided with him and his taking over Jerusalem, he paid them. He bribed them. And anyone who opposed him, he slaughtered them, is what he ended up doing. Yeah, showing regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So those who forsake the Mosaic Law, forsake the Lord God, to follow him, he blesses them. Does all of this sound familiar with this end time ruler called Antichrist? What's he going to do when he comes to power over the Holy Land? What's he going to do to the Jews? Isn't he going to track them down and put them to death unless they do what? Take the mark of the beast and confess him? Does all this sound familiar? We've had one in past history that literally did this. History records this. These prophecies were, remember, from Daniel's vantage point, all 135 of these, this entire section is all predictive prophecy. And history backs it up that it came to pass literally. Do you see why liberal commentators have such a huge problem with this book? If you have a Daniel that lived after all these events, and he's got these historical reports, it's not a problem for him to sit down and write all this. He can put 135 prophecies down here because they weren't prophecy. He's writing history. And that's what professors would say in liberal colleges, and even some today in not-so-liberal colleges would say that type of thing. He's writing after the fact. It's a pseudo-Daniel. It's someone who took the name of Daniel the prophet, but he's writing all of this after the events have occurred. If you come to this chapter believing in our God's all-powerful, he's the sovereign God, he's the one that raised up Daniel and placed him where he was, and all of this is concerning his holy people, the people of the Holy Covenant, those of the Mosaic Law, those that are in covenant with God. And it's not a problem for us. This chapter should just amaze us. When you sit and scratch your head as you read through here, and last week we tried to take that opportunity to show you all the former, the latter, the king of the north, and we went through and tried to put the names on each of those individuals and just show you that seesaw struggle and how we go through a couple hundred years from 323 down to 163, and how all these events transpired, and how Daniel, from his vantage point, now you know why he was sick and upset for days as he was writing this down. He couldn't understand it. Just so condensed and just so full, and trying to figure out how all this applies. Do you think he got it, that if in the future there's going to be this guy named Alexander the Great that's going to come to power here shortly, and he's going to die and his kingdom's going to be divided up among his four generals, and you've got this northern general and you got the southern general? Well, that's Syria, and that was Syria in Daniel's day, not yet quite Syria, but you got this northern kingdom, you got this southern kingdom, which had always been Egypt. And Daniel, as he wrote all this, he had to figure this out. I don't know if he fixed himself a linear chart here and had a map out in front of him, but he had this figured out, that this north and south, this struggle that's going to go on for these several hundred years, who's in the middle of all this? It had to cause him to grieve even more, to pray even harder. And yet he was recording prophecy and history before it had even transpired, so it's going to happen.
And at
this appointed time, over and over and over we read those words. Verse 29, at the appointed time, at the appointed time, throughout these sections. Who appoints the time? Our sovereign God. Those are the little jewels that you want to look for as you read through the scripture. At the appointed time. Verse 31, and forces from him will arise and desecrate the sanctuary fortress and do away with regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation. So forces from him are going to go forth and desecrate the temple. Antiochus ordered his general, Apollonius, with a contingent of some 22,000 soldiers. They marched on Jerusalem and went in and just began another slaughter, a bloodbath. Apollonius killed many Jews, took Jewish women and children captive, and took them back up to Syria. Antiochus's objective was to exterminate Judaism and to Hellenize the Jews, to make it a Greek state. What was Alexander the Great's dream? What did he do wherever he conquered? He Hellenized, didn't he? Brought in Greek language, brought in Greek culture, and that's what Antiochus was trying to do here to Jerusalem, to do away with their monotheism and their worship of one God. The abomination of desolation that he set up is he resurrected, according to historians, he put up a statue of Zeus over the sacrificial altar. He set up a statue of Zeus, and he went into the Holy of Holies and tore it all up and set up a statue of Zeus. And then he offered pig's swine, a pig's blood, sacrificed a pig in the Holy of Holies. Totally desecrated the sanctuary with the abomination of desolation. Jesus says that the final Antichrist in Matthew 24, he will come to power and he will set up the abomination of desolation. And that's at the midpoint, we believe, of the tribulation period. 3.5 years, there will be a pseudo-world peace. Looks like Israel's prospering without fences, without borders, without problems. And then in the midst of that final 7-year tribulation in the future, the final Antichrist will come into the sanctuary, tear it down, defile it, set up an image of himself and demand to be worshipped as God, and set about a persecution against the Jews worldwide and slaughter anyone that won't take his name and bow before him and give him allegiance. So all of this, isn't it? I don't know about you, but I think it's amazing how this foreshadows the final Antichrist that we'll read about next week in verses 36 to 45. The end time ruler, the Antichrist, fully energized and empowered by Satan. Do you think Antiochus was empowered by Satan? I believe he was. Where did he get all this genius and the ability to be so intriguing in the brutalism that he exercised? So as a culminating measure, he installed this image of Zeus, the Greek god, and that's in 2 Maccabees chapter 6, verse 2, for those of you that are reading through this. And if you want to read about his Hellenization policy and his destruction of Jerusalem, that's in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verses 44 to 54, in the book of Maccabees, if that's interesting to you. 1 Maccabees 1, and then 2 Maccabees 6 talks about these incidents in the books of the Maccabees. As a culminating effort to Hellenize and to destroy the Jewish system of worship and offering, he sacrificed a pig, an unclean animal, to the Jews upon their altar. And this happened on December 16th, 168 BC. And that date's important because the Judas Maccabeus is going to liberate Jerusalem on that same date later. December 16th, 168, and in December 16th, I believe it's 164, Judas Maccabeus is going to be able to liberate Jerusalem. Antiochus further ordered his subjects to celebrate subsequent birthdays by offering up a pig to Zeus on this altar. And he did this for several years before Judas Maccabeus, before there was a small contingent of Jews that rebelled against this under the leadership. It was a guerrilla warfare under the leadership of Judas Maccabeus and his sons, and others began to join them, and he was eventually able to overthrow Antiochus. And it's interesting, Maccabee means hammer. So this guy's the sledgehammer that's going to come, Judas Maccabeus. His nickname was the hammer, the sledgehammer. And he's able to cleanse Judaism and restore it. Verse 32, by smooth words, He will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly towards the covenant, but the people will know their God. People who know their God will display strength in action. So that's the first mention of Judas Maccabeus and others that join him. Those who truly know their God. So did Judas Maccabeus truly know the Lord? Sounds like it here, just this little reference, doesn't it? But the point being, I love the difference here in verse 32. Antiochus is going to use smooth words to turn to godlessness those who act wickedly towards the covenant. So there's going to be a contingency of Jews that he's going to bring over to his side, those who are in authority, those who are in power. He'll bring them under his realm by smooth words. Flattery. He uses flattery and promises to the people. And 1 Maccabees 1:11-15 talks about how he sees control through flattery. 1 Maccabees 1:11-15. And how the people participated in Zeus worship, the Greek god Zeus, and how so many people came over to Antiochus and worshiped Zeus and did whatever he said. We have to maintain peace after all. We have to get along with our captors. Jerome tells us in his commentary that this tyrant was a past master in manipulating Jewish leaders who were divided in their loyalties, winning them over to his cause by glowing promises of preferential treatment and reward. And as a matter of fact, Antiochus already had as his partisans for his cause a considerable number of the influential Jewish leaders in society and politics. They were convinced of his expediency of bringing about a pro-Hellenistic policy. And Jesus, when the New Testament opens, all of this is the background to the opening of the New Testament gospel for us, and Jesus coming on the scene. You had these different parties in Jerusalem that were in control. You had the Pharisees, you had the Sadducees, and then you had the Hasidim, who were the radicals, the super nationalistic Orthodox Jews that wanted to destroy their captors. These groups all emerged from this transition, from this point forward. You've got the nationalists that want to get back to the Mosaic law and live by the law and bring in what's good for Israel and for God's God over Israel. You've got the Sadducees, who are the money men. They're the money people who want to be political. We need to do what's expedient to keep peace and keep the peace here. Then you've got the Pharisees. They're the keepers of the law. They strain at gnats and swallow camels. They're the law guys that are trying to observe the laws of Moses, but there's no reality behind them. And so you have these parties come to power during this next 100 years or so in the opening of the New Testament, and they will be in place when Jesus comes on the scene, John the Baptist comes on the scene. So much of this background information, that's why that's important to know where these different political parties are. And the ones you gotta love are the Hasidims. That's Judas Maccabeus. That's the sledgehammer and his followers. You've heard about the caves where they found the Dead Sea Scrolls. That was from the community of the Essenes. They were Hasidim. They were so disgusted by another 50 years or so, they become so disgusted with all the politicizing going on up in Jerusalem that they withdraw to the caves in the sectarian community just on the northwest of the Dead Sea out there. It's basically wilderness. Nothing there. There's caves. And so they withdrew from Jerusalem and said it was all totally perverted. The priesthood was perverted. They're buying their offices, which was all true. And they wanted a pure Israel. And so they moved out to the desert and they began looking for this one promised in Daniel 7, the Son of Righteousness. They began to look for him. And they even said that they had among them the Teacher of Righteousness. So they had their own Messiah at the time, but they all knew he wasn't really the Messiah. But they pulled aside. They wanted the Mosaic Law. They wanted God. They wanted purity. And that's the community of the Essenes. They were Hasidim. And then, of course, there were the political Hasidim. that were fighting it out up in Jerusalem against the Romans and against the establishment. So all of that plays in to this background information here. Verse 33, those who have insight among the people will give understanding to many, yet they will fall by the sword and by the flame, by captivity, by plunder for many days. So those who oppose Antiochus, those who oppose the establishment, those who have understanding of God's word and try to help the people and purify the people, what's going to be their lot in life? They're going to fall by the sword, by flame, by captivity. Theirs is going to be a tough go. Anything new there around the world? Is that not the same? What happens to those in China that outwardly stand up and express faith in Christ, especially in latter years? It's softening up now more and more. Do you know the Dallas Seminary has been chosen to be the official theological seminary of China? They got websites set up all over China now where hundreds, thousands are showing up to get Dallas Seminary training online. Can't believe it. I think I've told you that the minister of religious affairs of China has been made many trips to Dallas and sitting in the office at Dallas Seminary. Probably award. I'm sure they awarded him one.
If he's making many trips, he may have to make many.
He's a total atheist, and yet he believes that religion for the people, it's good. It's good. Just keep the masses happy. Give them a little religion, and they've chosen. He selected Dallas Seminary because he said, out of all the different mission sending agencies, most of them were in there trying to take advantage of the Chinese. But Dallas Seminary has always been there to give Bibles and to give the Word of God. And he doesn't believe it or understand it himself, but Dallas Seminary is the one. And it's a fabulous story behind all that. And those on our Wednesday night, I shared that with you, where Dallas had a whole series of articles about how God brought that all about. And who did it all start with? You remember? Ron Allen. Professor Ron Allen, in a big church out in Northern California, Chinese church, thousands of Chinese, super wealthy businessmen. Well, one of the Chinese businessmen that was there when Ron Allen made a trip through there a couple years ago and was a guest speaker there, this Chinese businessman followed him to Dallas and made an appointment to see him and took him to lunch and talked with him and said he'd like to see President Bailey and meet President Bailey and talk to him about getting classes online. How come you don't have classes online? And so Ron said, well, we've got a few, but it's all about the money. And he said, well, set up a lunch date. So they went to lunch, President Bailey, Ron Allen, and a few others. They went to lunch, and this man said to Mark Bailey, I see, I've checked out your webpage. There's a few classes online, but we need them in Chinese. We got billions of Chinese. You need to put them in Chinese. And Mark Bailey said, well, we'd love to do that, but it costs money. And the man said, how much does it cost to do a course? He said, well, it costs thousands and thousands of dollars. You know, and he's just being kind of general. Well, after lunch and dessert, this guy whipped out the old checkbook and got his pen and wrote a check and ripped her out and slid it across the table to Mark Bailey. And he said, this ought to help you get started. He said, when can we expect the first class in Chinese? Mark Bailey picked up the check. It was $1 million. He said, it'll be out soon. God opened an unbelievable door through that Chinese businessman, and that man had such powerful connections in the garment industry throughout China that China now, the head of the state atheistic religion, has been to Dallas Seminary, and he's letting them in key cities all over China now, and they've got these training centers with computers, and there's pictures of just hundreds of them crammed into these spaces watching Ron Allen and Dwight Pentecost. I wonder how they translate. For Dr. P, you know. Amazing! In Chinese! What's that have to do with anything? Just an exciting story to see how our God, there will be some among the people that will give understanding to the many. There's always that elect group that don't want to follow the persecution and follow the falsehood, that want the truth, that don't want to just go to church and warm a pew and may be made to feel good, but want to give sacrificially, that want to give of their time, that want to serve a body, that want to be part of a body that is supporting missions. The Sunday before last, we had a special request, an emergency from Word of Life over there in Budapest, Hungary. They had a break-in, and some of their equipment was stolen. their major sanctuary projectors, super old piece of junk. And they've got the largest enrollment they've ever had, and they needed a projector. So I talked with the elders before church, and we held it up before the people. We raised $1,000. They got a brand new 3,000 lumen projector. They can't even believe it. I can't believe it. That's fabulous, absolutely fabulous, to be able to do things like that. That's what we need to be about. Where can we get the most bang for our buck? You're reaching, those who gave to that are reaching 150 young people over there at Word of Life that have dramatic transformations of these young people from this former communist rule, and still a lot of it's been beat into them through their educational system, and they get saved. I mean, it's dramatic Book of Acts conversions with the young men and women I met there and had the privilege to teach last February. Just fabulous. And yet it's all, and money, the dollar keeps getting devaluated over there, and so the money we give, they said, can you, you know, you've given that money, would you hold it, and I'll find a projector, would you buy it, and then I'll have you send it to Tom Treats coming over to help us with some architectural designs, send the camera to him, and he'll bring it in. That's how they get the stuff in. Just amazing stories.